Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Gates, how Erdc makes the difference. I'm Annette Kirkland and welcome to the show. We're on season 2, episode 10 this morning, and we're going to be talking about flooding effects on trees. I'm here with Dr. Nathan Bean, research forester with the Wetlands and Coastal Ecology Branch with the Environmental Lab, otherwise known as EL. Good morning, Dr. Bean.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great this morning. So happy to have you on the show.
I'm happy to be here.
So we have lots of important information to talk about flooding effects on trees, but the first question is, what is your role at Erdc?
Sure, thank you. I'm glad to be here. The simple answer is that I study trees, but my official title is research forester, and my training and background is in forest ecology, which is simply defined as the study of forest ecosystem to like understand the complexities of forest, how they grow, and how we can effectively manage them. So at Erdc, our research primarily falls into two categories. We have civil works, which is kind of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers focus, or USACE, and then we have military efforts, which are Department of Defense or DOD research efforts. And within those two categories, we have research that's funded under what we call direct research programs and work that's performed as reimbursable research. This is where we typically have a single customer, where our direct programs are aimed at larger, bigger challenges across multiple sites, for example. As a result, our work is highly variable, and it's aimed at addressing general research challenges. As I mentioned, the direct programs, for example, I'm working on a project where we're modeling forest characteristics at a global scale for military planning. And then we also have specific research goals that are reimbursable, for example, of how we look at an invasive species that might be impacting forest at a specific core project or at a military installation. With the Department of Defense owning approximately 30 million acres and the Corps of Engineers managing approximately 12 million acres and having 400 projects across 43 states, there's a lot of places where there's forest and a lot of work to be done that I come in to support. And the USACE, interestingly enough, is one of the largest providers of outdoor recreation. They have more visitors per year than the national parks do, with an estimate of around 260 million per year, I believe.
Okay. That's a lot of roll.
That's
right. So here's a fun subject. Tell me about yourself and your background, and what steps did you take to get to where you are, and what is your relationship with the community?
Okay, that's a lot of a question.
It's a loaded question.
So steps to get here. I was born and raised in El Dorado, Arkansas. I'm about 2.5 hours from Vicksburg. I'm in El Dorado, situated at the bottom of the state, kind of in the very center, so right next to the Louisiana line. Even from my early childhood, I've eagerly chased opportunities to be outside. I love the outdoors, and while I had originally planned to kind of pursue a degree in engineering, while I started college, I decided that being outside was really a passion of mine, and I decided to get a degree that would ensure me some more time in the woods. And so I pursued a bachelor's degree in forestry, and I went to the only four-year program in Arkansas. It's at the University of Arkansas at Monticello. This small town provided a small classroom size, but also a wonderful experience for learning. After my first class in dendrology, which is the study of trees, I knew I could learn all these trees, and the seed, pun intended, had been planted.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. And so nearing graduation, I was probably a month out. I had it all worked out. I'm a big planner, and I was going to graduate my forestry degree and work for a consultant back in El Dorado in my hometown. And he had purchased me a pickup truck, and I was going to be ready to go day one of summer to start my new job. And my silviculture professor one afternoon, you know, nothing goes as planned. He'd called me in this afternoon and asked me if I was interested in an opportunity to go to graduate school. And I had never thought of such a thing. I was shocked. I had not even looked at an opportunity such as that. But I was excited for even being asked and the thought that I could do such a thing. And so I excitedly said yes. So I called my employer back home and told him that, you know, plans had changed. And he wasn't too impressed, but understood the unique opportunity and, you know, had wished me the best. Again, talking about how things change, as the final weeks of my undergraduate degree were closing in, the professor, he called me back to his office with some unexpected news. He had taken his new job and was moving to Morgantown, West Virginia, and starting a new position at WVU, or West Virginia University. At this point, I had quit my future job and had placed all my eggs in this graduate school basket. So I was bummed and not sure how everything was going to play out. But I stayed optimistic, and the opportunity to continue graduate work at either from WVU studying at a site in Arkansas or moving to West Virginia and finding a new project to work on there was on the table. And so I had decided if I was going to go to West Virginia and begin a graduate school program that I should study there too. And so this would be a new place, it'd be a mountainous region, and a chance to work in a new and different forest. And all that was exciting, and I decided to pursue that. So I graduated from UAM in Monticello, Arkansas in May of 2005. I got married in July and started my new life in Morgantown in August of that year. It was a whirlwind of a summer, but all for the better. And so for my master's degree, I'm now in a new place, new state, new forest, new trees. I'd studied what was called an old-growth hemlock hardwood forest, and it was nestled in the Appalachian Mountains, and it was being attacked by this invasive pest that they call the hemlock woolly adelgid. These hemlock forests are really cool. They're dense stands. They're cold because they're such dark and kind of situated in the mountains. And this adelgid defoliates these trees and ultimately kills them. And so my work was focused on quantifying the damage and providing management recommendations on treating and restoring forests during and following this adelgid outbreak. And so that experience of spending an entire summer in such a unique forest type in the mountains was surreal. I loved what I was doing and couldn't get enough of studying trees and forest, and I'd officially become a tree nerd. So I continued to nerd out and stayed at WVU and pursued my doctorate degree in forest ecology. And so for that work, I spent two summers studying in high elevation red spruce forest, which is a rare forest type in that state, and got to camp throughout the million-acre Monongahela National Forest and evaluated this forest type. And the goal of that work was to assist with restoration research and derive climate adaptation strategies that would alleviate the impacts of this of species that were in that forest type that were either considered endangered or even endemic, which means they occur there and nowhere else in the world. And because this forest type is so rare and occurs on the tops of these mountains, understanding how we could manage those and restore that forest is really important. So stayed there, and in August of 2010, I was kind of getting in the final year of my PhD work, and I had the opportunity to interview at ERDC for a position in the environmental laboratory. I was still finishing up my dissertation. I'd be finished in December, but I was actively searching for job opportunities, and this job was a place that I'd never even heard about. Even being from Arkansas, I didn't know ERDC existed and had never visited Vicksburg. I fly back home. I'm back at WVU. I'm focused on my efforts, and it was crickets. No reply, no follow-up, no comments. I heard nothing. So I spent the next few months just finishing up my dissertation, and I defended as I had planned in December of 2010. And so, ironically, and perhaps planned, but not to my knowledge, the day I defended and was officially going to be a graduate, I was offered the job at ERDC. And so it was a euphoric experience. I was happy to be done with my grad school and defended this dissertation, which was you know, a big milestone for me. But I was more excited about the opportunity that awaited. I had gone to school, but now had a job, right? And that was a big deal to me. So the next month, January of 2011, I started my career with ERDC and have been there ever since. An interesting thing about moving to ERDC, so I did the PCS thing where they, you know, help you move all of your gear. They don't move certain things, and I'm a collector of hobbies, and we'll talk about that in this episode, I think. But they don't move guns, propane, honeybees.
And yes, he said honeybees, everyone.
That's right. And house plants. And so being a tree guy, I like growing plants. And so I had all of these things to move, and I had this little single cab, Toyota Tacoma pickup, and we're leaving a very mountainous region. When it was in December, there was a couple feet of snow on the ground, and I'm pulling my wife's little Honda Civic in the car behind us. And so I had stuffed that car full of all these house plants and the propane, and I had inside my truck the rifles and stuff that I hunt with and our little dog, and I put our beehives in the back of this truck. And so I have three hives in the back, and we leave this, you know, very cold environment and start driving south. And so I think we spend the night in Tennessee, and the next day we're driving into Meridian, and we pull over to get lunch, and it's a nice day in Mississippi. So right. It's in December, it's 55 degrees and sunny, and I look in the side mirror as my wife goes in to get food, and I notice a honeybee. And so I just thought other bees in the area, it was a nice day, had found my hives, because we secure them to travel so that they don't get out, but they have to be able to breathe. So I put like a little piece of window screen across their hive entrance. And anyway, I look on the other mirror and I see another bee. And so then I decide to look in the rearview mirror and I see thousands of bees flying.
Man.
And so I, you know, call my wife, tell her to forget about the food, come on outside, we've got an issue, and we had to get out of there. And so we drove down the road and I resecured my bees. But it was a really interesting experience moving here with having, you know, my hives come unleashed in the shopping center in Meridian. But we got here and everything went really good, and started my job at ERDC. And so the second part of your question was relationship to the community. While not traveling, which I do a lot for this job, most of my time is spent out of the state, I really enjoy spending time at home. We have a little 8-acre place just south of Vicksburg, and I spend as much of my time outside as possible. As I mentioned, I'm a collector of hobbies. I enjoy gardening, beekeeping. I have just started growing a muscadine vineyard, and I maintain my own home orchard. We have blackberries, blueberries, peaches, pears, and plums. We also raise chickens, ducks, geese, and heritage pigs. And in a different life, I would have been what they call a professional abattoir, which is like a meatsmith or a butcher.
Okay.
Oddly enough, while I love growing food, the butchering part's where I really focus my talents. When you grow your own animals or you hunt for food, utilization is really a big part that's important.
Right.
You don't want to waste what you've put so much time and effort into. And, you know, you're taking that animal's life, and to waste it just isn't right.
Right.
So I nerd out on that part and really enjoy that process more than most. And I even can a lot of deer meat, which most people have never heard of or thought about doing. But when you don't have access to refrigeration or you're limited on freezer space, knowing things like that are really important. And at minimum, you get to be the coolest person on a camping trip when you have food that doesn't have to go in the cooler.
Okay.
And that often leads to adventure and experiences in nature. And these hobbies keep me sane, and I really enjoy time at home and learning all of those things.
Plus, you get your family involved.
Which sure. Yeah, absolutely. So regarding community input, I served as the outdoors editor for the Mississippi magazine called The Sip for several years.
Mm-hmm.
I would share outside adventures that ran the gamut from, you know, raising and training my own squirrel hunting dog to floating down the Mississippi River in December in a 30-foot wooden canoe. And that writing experience was an outlet to share my love for the outdoors, and I really enjoyed that time. And I think the community enjoyed those articles as well, a taste of the outdoors. So I also volunteer my time to share and teach knowledge of trees. I mentioned my tree nurse capacity, and I'm happy to share that with others. And that ranges from working with Boy Scout and Girl Scout troops, where we learn, for example, what tree rings tell us about the environment. I also support the GEMS camp, which is the Gains in Education of Math and Science, and that's kind of a summer STEM program that's sponsored by the Army. I've taught large groups of middle school age GEM students for years, and I've also hosted some individual summer internships with some high school age students for that program.
And we had Tracy Gordon last week talking about those camps.
Cool.
So that works out perfect.
It's a good deal to be involved with. So as part of my job with ERDC, I also instruct career professionals across the country. You know, I'm primarily teaching folks how to evaluate forest and do restoration research. And we do teach a class up at Terra every other year at Terra Wildlife. That's kind of a USA-sponsored class that we teach here locally.
Okay.
So I enjoy teaching. The efforts that involve the kiddos are assuredly the most rewarding. The Girl Scout troops are always just a real blast. They're lively kids that really enjoy learning about the outdoors. And I have a 5-year-old daughter at home, and so I'm hopeful that if she learns anything from me, it's that, you know, to enjoy natural things, and I'm hopefully getting experience in teaching these young'uns how to do that.
That's great. Wow. Just wow. I think everybody else is going to say wow. I'm Annette Kirkland. Beyond the Gates continues in a moment. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
Is it taking forever to back up your photos and videos to the cloud? IT support can be more pain than relief. Do you have an overpriced phone service? If you answered yes to any of this, you need to call New Break Communications at 601-456-0556. Locally owned and operated, and now offering IT support for business and home with the fastest upload speeds in Vicksburg. And we get your data to the cloud faster than anyone. Call 601-456-0556. From the keyboard to the cloud, we're with you all the way. New Break Communications.
For 12 years, James Leo has been servicing the Vicksburg and surrounding areas, doing full-service regular pest and termite control. Be aware, termite season is going on now. Locally owned and operated, Leo's Pest Control is licensed, bonded, and insured with reasonable and competitive rates. Call 769-282-4570. That's 769-282-4570. And follow us on Facebook at Leo's Pest Control.
Bad boys, what you gonna do?
Next time you buy eggs at your favorite supermarket, look for the FPI symbol, which stands for foam packaging. And it also means that egg carton was made right here in Vicksburg at their plant on Highway 61. Foam packaging manufactures polystyrene foam packaging products like egg cartons, food serving trays, produce trays, and more. At Foam Packaging, our goal is to provide our customers with exceptional service, high quality products, and competitive pricing. Since 1971, customers have trusted Foam Packaging of Vicksburg. Foam Packaging, a company we can all be proud of.
Welcome back to Beyond the Gates. You're listening to News Talk 107.7. So if you're just tuning in, I am speaking with Dr. Nathan Bean. He's a research forester with the Wetlands and Coastal Ecology Branch with the Environmental Laboratory, otherwise known as EL. And we're going to be talking about flooding effects on trees. So I understand that you work extensively with trees, as we just talked about. Can you tell us why are forests and or trees important to the environment and how they are managed?
Sure. Why trees? Well, I have a bumper sticker that I keep in my office that says trees are the answer. Why not trees would be my opposing question. What don't they do? My daughter loves to share this dad joke. Why should you stay away from trees? And her answer is because they're pretty shady.
Wow.
And as funny as that joke is, there's great merit in the shade that trees provide. That shade cools water temperatures and streams, and that shade is formed by leaves that absorb carbon from the atmosphere and generate oxygen. Trees improve air quality, they ameliorate climate impacts, they conserve water and reduce runoff and preserve soil. Not to mention the wildlife value that forests offer with respect to food, shelter, and sites for reproduction and nesting. Trees really are the answer, in my opinion. Regarding your question of how they're managed, that's a little bit more tricky, and it depends, and it can occur in a multitude of ways depending on the type of forest that it is and the intended use by the landowner or the person responsible for its management. Forests can be managed for timber production, wildlife and waterfowl habitat, as riparian corridors and buffers, which is a lot of what the coursework we teach across the country is, and that's just to name a few. But knowing how they should be managed is critical, and that's where the role of a knowledgeable forest or a forest ecologist like myself is essential. They can help landowners or entities make necessary determinations for species selection, management strategies such as thinning or prescribed fire, and ensure that management mimics natural processes or the commercial interests that are aligned to the landowner's goals and objectives.
Okay, so that's why.
Why?
Okay. So with most of your work performed across the country, can you share any work you've done in Mississippi?
Sure thing. So we have a project here in the Mississippi Delta that's looking at the impacts of prolonged riverine flooding on oak-dominated forests that occur in the floodplain. So floodplain are areas that are low-lying, that are adjacent to a river, and that flood frequently. So I'm sure as the listeners are fully aware, flooding can have significant impacts to this region, and impacting people, homes, and lands, both agricultural and forest land. And in recent years, the magnitude of flooding has been significant. As I mentioned, I moved to Vicksburg in January of 2011, and that year the Mississippi River flooded over the roadway on Highway 61 South, where the Big Black River runs into the Mississippi. And that's kind of where I live, in that south part of town. And just seeing that and that magnitude was just really impressive to me, and I didn't understand the magnitude of what the river can hold in terms of water and where that flooding can have impact. So in 2019, there was another big flood event that happened that caused impacts in the Batcher. So Batcher is like the areas between the Mississippi levee and the Mississippi River. And then there's also backwater habitats that flood as a result of high water levels. And along the Mississippi River, there are gauges that monitor those water levels. And here in Vicksburg, we have a gauge. And during this 2019 flood, the water levels exceeded the flood stage for 168 consecutive days. And the unique part about this flood was when it happened. I like kind of milestones to think of the dates of flooding. And so essentially from Valentine's Day all the way through the 4th of July, there was flooding that was happening in the Mississippi Delta. And it was extensive flooding. So in some areas, particularly in that Batcher environment, that area between the levee and the river, there were places that got 20 feet of water in some of those forested areas at the peak of the flood. And so I mentioned floodplain, but now we'll talk a little bit about floodplain forests. So as the name suggests, these are forests that are adapted to grow in areas that are frequently saturated or areas that are often inundated by water, and sometimes at high magnitude when these big flood events happened. In fact, a lot of our bottomland hardwood forests can be inundated for several months during the dormant season. So when leaves are off the trees with little to no impact, we actually have forests that we manage as green tree reservoirs where they're flooded for waterfowl habitat in the wintertime when the trees are dormant. And there's little effect to those trees from flooding. However, what they're not used to is the period of time when the 2019 flood occurred, which is throughout much of the growing season. So the growing season is a time when trees are doing their thing, right? Leaves are out, they're conducting photosynthesis, and they're storing sugars for growth and future resource needs. And when floodwaters persist into the summer months, well, then trees are going to have a problem, and the impacts to some of those species that are in that floodplain and the age of the cohorts of those individuals that are growing there can be detrimental. So now that we have a picture in our heads of the duration and magnitude of the 2019 flood, let's talk about what I found that was so bizarre. So the floodwaters had receded in early August. So remember, they came right around Valentine's Day. They went all the way through the 4th of July, and the waters kind of moved out in the early August time frame. And I'm a avid hunter. I spend a lot of my time on public land in the Mississippi Delta. And that December, so this is 4 months after this long-term extreme flood event, I took notice that there was extensive oak regeneration in some of the delta. So oak regeneration are small trees that establish, in this case, because they're oaks from an acorn, and they germinate and grow into these small seedlings. And these seedlings are what I just observed large patches of, and sometimes tens and thousands of individuals in unique areas. And so it's not a crazy thing to see, but after a growing season flood event that lasted 168 days where there were water in these locations in that same year, that's pretty bizarre. You know, how could this be? And a bald cypress, for example, our most flood-adapted swamp forest species, can't germinate in water. And so what's going on here? And how are these trees, particularly these oak trees, adapting to this environmental impact? And so while my focus was on deer and hogs that day while hunting, my mind ran astray with, like, what's going on with respect.
Because you're the tree nerd.
That's right. With That's this right. oak regeneration, what is really going on here? And so, for the listeners who are not particularly familiar with oak trees, we'll dive into this conundrum a little bit deeper. I think it'd be helpful. So all oak trees produce acorns, and there's two general, you know, quote, types of oaks. For the tree nerds, these groups are called subgenera of the oak genus Quercus. But for the rest of the world, we'll broadly name these groups the red oak type and the white oak type. And this includes many species of oaks in the Delta, and they all fit into one of these two groups. But knowing which one is important, not only to identify the species, but for where we explore next, which is how they start their life as a tree. So oak trees produce acorns, and they fall in the fall, or the autumn season of the year. And when bow hunters hit the woods in October, the oak trees dropping the most acorns is where they usually hone in to go find their deer. And over the next couple of months, depending on a host of conditions, all of those acorns will hit the ground. And from there, whether you're an acorn in that white oak group or the red oak group comes into play. When a white oak acorn falls, relatively quickly that acorn breaks open and a primary root called a radicle is sent out and grows into the ground. Then over the next few weeks, this split acorn will send out a small stem upright and create baby leaves that we call cotyledons. Then that seedling will sit tight and hold its ground, literally, until the spring arrives when growing can fully commence. But that red oak group does the exact opposite. Those acorns hit the ground in the fall, and they wait until the springtime to do any growing. And so these adaptations and growth strategies in relation to the timing and duration of that 2019 flood now become really interesting, right? If you're a white oak, you would have been a young and vulnerable seedling when the floodwaters arrived, and your chance of surviving with nearly 6 months of flooding seems pretty bleak. And if you're a red oak and you're still in an unopened acorn status, your chances of, quote, holding your ground are pretty bleak. But perhaps your survivability chances are increased because your acorn hasn't opened up and you have that layer of protection. So nothing in nature is easy to understand without in-depth examination. And to dive into what's going on here, we're establishing permanent plots in the Mississippi Delta in those batcher and backwater habitats to examine these long-term effects of prolonged riverine flooding and how they correlate to the dynamics we're observing with respect to oak regeneration in the Delta during the 2019 flood.
Okay, so you just brought up permanent plots. Can you explain what they are and why they are important?
Absolutely. So permanent plots are a different animal compared to normal forest inventory plots that we traditionally use to assess forest conditions. So permanent plots are carefully installed. They have a specific location and reference trees that we established to allow for long-term monitoring of a very specific location in the trees in that vicinity, so that even if a tornado event destroys all the trees, we can retrace that exact location and identify what happened, what was lost, and what species, for example, are impacted. A lot of time is invested in ensuring these plots are set up so that we can retrace them in future years to provide a long-term assessment of a particular site. And when we do that, we get the ability to evaluate specific trees at that location and their permanency. We are afforded the opportunity to evaluate long-term trends in tree regeneration, which is how the trees come into a site and begin from seedlings, tree mortality, which is how those trees are dying, and also snag retention. So a snag is a standing dead tree, and that's a really valuable thing to wildlife habitat for nesting and food sources. They like the dead trees. So snag retention is really important in a lot of wildlife studies. And so with these long-term plots, we can look at how long an individual species, let's say oak, would stay in its condition as a standing dead tree compared to a hickory or an ash or a walnut or that kind of thing. Right. And that really helps us look and understand what these forests are doing and how they're providing a wildlife benefit. And so overall, these permanent plots are great because we can look at forest composition over time. And that's kind of a rare thing. And more importantly for this work in the Mississippi Delta, after the flood events happen, some of these large trees are dying, right? So we have these big 40-inch diameter oak trees, and they may succumb to the flood events. Well, not all those trees are dying. So a really unique part of this is that we can come back to these sites 5 years, 10 years, even 20 years later, and using dendrochronology, so study of tree rings, we can core those trees, which does not hurt them. Trees are only alive on the outside part of their bark inside. It's just inside the bark. It's called the cambium layer. And that's the only part of a tree that's living. And so when a woodpecker puts 600 holes around the side of a tree, it doesn't really impact it. And that's why, because only the exterior part of that tree is alive. And so we can take cores out of that tree all the way to the pith and really cause very minimal damage, no different than a wood-boring insect or a woodpecker would cause. And that allows us to then age that tree and also look at the growth pattern at an annual basis. So we can go back 5 years, 10 years after these flood events to trees that survived and identify how much of an impact that flood have had on that tree, as well as get an understanding of, is that tree recovering back to a normal status, or is this, you know, a perturbation that's now going to be exacerbated over time with another flood event and eventually cause that tree to die. So our ability to do that is really important for establishing these permanent plots so that we can get that foundational data and then over time be able to go back and reassess those areas to see how they're changing and then get further informed decision using tools like dendrochronology.
Okay. I'm Annette Kirkland. Beyond the Gates continues in a moment. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
Lorelei Books knows the power of regional food, and nowhere is that more thoroughly captured than in the Edible South. Author Marcy Cohen Ferris presents food as a new way to chronicle the American South's larger history. She tells a richly illustrated story of Southern food and the struggles of whites, blacks, Native Americans, and others as they try to nourish their bodies along with their minds, livelihoods, and lands. We see the lens of food focused on colonial settlements, on plantation homes, in New South cities, and at civil rights era lunch counters. Ferris reveals how food, both as cuisine and commodity, has shaped Southern identity over the centuries, leading to the present day in this landmark study, The Edible South. This is Kelly Barfield at Lorelei Books, loving the tasty history of the South and its writers, who keep the love of literacy and learning alive.
Welcome back to Beyond the Gates. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Dr. Nathan Bean. We are talking about flooding effects on trees. He's a research forester with the Wetlands and Coastal Ecology Branch with the Environmental Lab, otherwise known as EL. So, I hear you work on more than just trees, though. Any other cool projects that you can tease or to mention to our listeners?
Yeah, I'll try. So I've worked all over the country in my now decade-long career at ERDC. It's hard to imagine I've been here 10-plus years, but I've had the opportunity to study cabbage palms in the Florida Everglades. I've also been in tundra habitats along the north slope of Alaska at the Bering Sea, as far north as you can go, and that's 12 and a half hours north on the ice road, Trucker's Road. I mean, it's really far-reaching places, and I wouldn't have been given this opportunity without my career here at ERDC. I've also been fortunate enough to assess forest in Spain and perform that dendrochronology research. As I mentioned, it's a study of tree rings in a boreal forest in Canada last summer, which was really interesting. Additionally, I've done a lot of research on wild pigs or feral swine or wild boars. There's a host of names that pigs get labeled, but I've I've done some really cool project work studying this mammal, and I've worked on military installations where we've performed telemetry work, where we affix GPS collars on wild pigs and deploy them in live fire and impact areas that are hard to access, so that we can look at the impacts that those groups, they're called sounders when it's a group of pigs, are having in those areas where it's limited access and hard to get into. And so there's pigs already in those locations, but by putting GPS collared pigs in those areas, they will then affiliate themselves with the sounders that are in those locations so that we can get real live, you know, 3-hour increment GPS coordinates of where those pigs are moving in those areas that are very hard to get to.
Okay.
And so by having those coordinates, we put out like 15 individual collared pigs. We were able to identify the habitats that they were utilizing seasonally and inform management efforts that are aimed at controlling their populations in these really kind of remote and large scale areas. So one of the project sites, for example, is Fort Hood. This is a 290,000 acre installation, and their live fire and impact areas are around 95,000 acres. So huge expanses of land. We're managing a invasive species that reproduces prolifically and can adapt and survive in any environment is really challenging. And so doing that kind of work through ERDC helps inform how we do management in those large scale areas where it's very, very challenging.
They can survive in any environment.
They're pretty incredible.
They, wow.
You know, they're omnivores. They eat anything. We did some stomach collection work on pigs that have been harvested to see what they're eating at certain times of year, because we knew where they were going based on the collars. So as they would do management action, we would pull those pigs out and look at what they were eating.
Right.
So we had an idea of like why they're selecting for specific areas, and we would find spark plugs and license plates and cow hides and you name it. They really are
a, like a shark.
They're an adaptive species and really are prolific on the landscape in a lot of locations. And as part of that work, it's now spun into more. And I mentioned those direct and reimbursable programs. So if we go to an installation and do a project like that, that's a reimbursable effort. But I'm also working on the civil side, so U.S. Army Corps of Engineers side. I'm doing a direct research program that's looking at doing feral swine damage assessments, and we're partnering with another federal agency, the USDA, and their economics project, where we're, my job is to quantify the damage. It's very easy to look at what pigs, where pigs are causing damage in an agricultural setting, for example, right? You see the farm field, it's near the road. If you want to look at a large area, you fly a drone and you can see those impacts that are happening. But you step into that forest, particularly like in our Mississippi Delta, where we have these large stands of, you know, palmettos, it's very hard to tell where the pigs are and what damage they're actually having to those habitats. So I'm working and partnering with other agencies to identify and create a rapid feral swine damage assessment protocol where we can go into those forests, quantify what the impacts are, and then that economics project with the USDA, they're helping us to develop economic models where we can assign valuation to the impacts that those wild pigs are having to natural resources. So really cool work, and no one's really doing that at a large scale, and, and we're trying to be able to adapt those to like regional frameworks that we could apply to multiple projects across the Corps.
Well, I know you probably piqued up a lot of listeners because I know it's they're an issue all around us.
They are.
Well, thanks for making that difference in what you do in your projects and through the trees and through the other work that you do. So here we go. We're wrapping up.
All right.
So what do you want listeners to remember from this valuable conversation?
Oh, man.
It's a deep one, isn't it?
Yeah. I guess it's that the science matters. So that doing the nerdy tree research work that I do to track, you know, the permanency and impacts of flooding that will improve our understanding of how forests respond to, you know, these large-scale environmental stresses and how we can manage them effectively to increase the resiliency of those forests or to augment or ameliorate those impacts. As I said earlier, trees are the answer, but we do need to study them to understand why. And so that's probably what I would ask the listeners to pay the most attention to. And this applies really broadly. As I'm a collector of hobbies, I'm a collector of research work. You know, I work in all of those direct and reimbursable programs, and we're doing work to model forests globally for military direct projects. And it's really important that we understand our forests, and they apply for military planning, but they also apply to how we manage feral pigs, and they also apply for how we're going to do flood risk management. They apply for how we're going to manage wild pigs on the landscape. And I think that's just a really valuable piece of of what ERDC does that's really unique and I've not experienced outside in the academic world.
Okay. Well, Dr. Bean, thank you so much for being on the show today. We've enjoyed it, and you know, I hope you come back to talk about another project.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed my time.
Well, thank you for listening to Beyond the Gates, How ERDC Makes a Difference, and we'll come back at you next week. Have a great day.
Now News Talk 1490 and 107.7 FM presents the legendary Paul Harvey and the rest of the story. And now...
Now, the rest of the story. In the annals of Western lore, no real-life cattleman or cowboy was ever more celebrated than Henry Hooker. Henry C. Hooker. His was the big cattle fortune. Many of the legends about cattle drives began with Henry Hooker. Hooker's Sierra Bonita Ranch in the San Simon Valley of Arizona used to be a desert oasis for the wealthy. Famous people came there to ride, to breathe the fresh air, to share for a while the cattleman's way of life. Separating the myth from the man, in a case like Cattle King Henry Hooker, is sometimes a difficult task. But the story you're about to hear is true, all right. This is about Hooker's first trail drive from Hangtown, California, across the Sierra Mountains to Carson City, Nevada. And you're going to hear the rest of the story. As a young man in the 1860s, many years away from his celebrity as a cattle baron, Henry Hooker ran a hardware store in Hangtown, California, and one night Henry's store burned down. He rescued $1,000 cash, nothing more. Now, it just happened that at the time the Comstock lode was booming. Better than 60 miles in a mountain range away was the thriving infant mining capital of Nevada, Carson City. Like many boom towns, Carson City had to import its food. Folks there had gold and silver, but they couldn't eat gold or silver. They needed food. So here's Henry Hooker back in Hangtown. His business is gone. He's sitting on 1,000 idle dollars. He's living smack dab in the middle of a livestock belt. Now, I know maybe you have anticipated Henry's next move. He took all of the money he had and he bought all of the livestock he could get his hands on, and he announced that he was going to drive this new herd across the high Sierras to Carson City. Everybody warned him against it. Some called him crazy. And the journey ahead was indeed a treacherous one. It is not recorded precisely how many head Henry was driving when he started out. But $1,000 at dirt cheap Hangtown prices meant a lot of meat, and at Carson City he could sell his herd for 10 times that, maybe 20 times. Henry used dogs on the first trail drive. The herd behaved itself through the lowlands, up into the mountains, past the snow line, but then one day after they had made it beyond the summit, the herd came to a precipitous drop-off. The dogs urged them forward. Henry spun round to see what was happening, and $1,000 worth of meat almost spilled over the edge into the gorge. But it did not. It did not. Henry Hooker and his herd eventually made it to Carson City. And there he sold the lot at $5 a head, which meant a handsome profit for him. And Henry took that money, and he bought his first Texas and New Mexico cattle. He started his Arizona ranch. And now you know the... Well, no, you don't. No, you don't. You remember that steep canyon Henry's herd encountered in the Sierra Mountains. You know why they didn't fall in? Because they flew over it. And if you could hear the ghostly echoes of Henry Hooker's first trail drive, they'd say, "Head 'em up, move 'em out, get them turkeys." Turkeys? Turkeys. That's right, cowman Henry Hooker could never have cashed in on cattle had he not once upon a time begun the accumulation of his fortune by driving a bunch of turkeys over the high Sierras to wealthy but hungry Carson City. And now, partners, you know the rest of the story.